Hello, and welcome to the Journal of American History podcast. I'm your host, Marina Meekum, editorial assistant for the Journal of American History and PhD candidate in history at Indiana University. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello, my name is Stephen Andrews, interim executive editor of the Journal of American History and an adjunct professor of history at Indiana University. I'm also an editor at Process, a blog for American history, and the consulting editor of The American Historian. My work in teaching focuses on the cultural and religious history of the United States, and I teach classes on religion, reform, and the Civil War. I'm also engaged in public history, appearing in the media to discuss the history of conspiracy theories and working to help educators address conspiracy theories in the classroom. Today, my guest is Britton Hopkins. Britton is the Mellon Postdoctoral Fellow in Sociology at Wellesley College. She completed her doctoral studies in geography at the University of Oxford as a Clarendon Scholar in 2021. She is currently expanding her doctoral research on the development of student loans in the United States into a manuscript entitled Indebted Subjects, The Origins of the Student Loan Industry in a Neoliberalizing United States. More broadly, her research is concerned with how contemporary forms of debt and indebtedness shape political governance in everyday life. In this episode, we discuss her article, The Origins of the Student Loan Industry in the United States, Richard Cornell, United Student Aid Funds, and the Creation of the Guaranteed Student Loan Program, which appeared in the March 2023 issue of the Journal of American History. Britton, thank you so much for joining us today. I think this is such an important topic that's, you know, it's in the news today, but it also has such a deep historical basis that most people don't understand, even academics, and understanding it, this article really opened my eyes to the kind of past that we're looking at. But how did you come to this work on the student loan industry?
So this project developed through my doctoral research into the origins of the student loan industry. And I undertook the project really out of a series of material conditions which made student loans relevant in my personal life and also in my understandings of politics more broadly. So I started my PhD in 2017, but I finished my undergraduate studies in 2009 during the financial crisis. And this is really a turning point in our understanding of student loans collectively as a society, I think, in part because of Occupy Wall Street in 2011. And the development of the debt collective is an offshoot of that movement, which has centered debt as a political issue in the United States and really undertook a process of denaturalizing the taken-for-grantedness of debt. So I came out of that era. That's the era that I graduated into and entered the labor force at that moment. Nevertheless, I came to the question of student debt initially from another angle. I had been living in Chile after graduating from college between 2009 and 2014, on and off. And during that time, there were large-scale student protests for social and political reforms throughout the country. So I saw people protesting in the thousands, and one of the key issues that I heard people talking about was the cost of higher education and the debt burdens which people carried with them because of this. And something that was different from my experience growing up in the United States, I frequently heard people refer to the term neoliberalism as a way to frame their understanding of the political conditions in which they were living. So I understood neoliberalism beginning from that point in relationship to student loan debt as not something that should be taken for granted and normal, but as a political issue that could be contested. So I began my doctoral studies in 2017, and I understood by that point that my material conditions upon graduating or finishing my doctoral studies within the labor market as a person who had student loans from studies prior to my PhD would be quite precarious, as they are for many people. Sure. And so I wanted, with my PhD research, to explore how student loans came to be. So initially, I was interested in researching something along the lines of debt-resistant movements in Chile in the United States and differences and similarities between them. But I realized as I started to undertake the project that there was a gap in understanding how student loans had arisen in the first place. So there was a gap in historical knowledge that needed to be attended to. And that's what brought me to this project.
That's great. So, I mean, so partially it's lived experience, partially it's historical moment and the context that you find yourself in. But I also was, I was drawn because we read things triple blind at the journal. So as I was reading your piece in its initial stages, I had no idea who the author was or anything about you. And it wasn't until fairly late in the process that I found out that you were a sociologist. So one of the things I was wondering is how is a, not just, you know, kind of context and lived experience, which is awfully crucial, but how do you think this question, the way you approach it, because when I read this piece, it seems very historical. I mean, as you just said, that's part of what you're filling in, but how was it influenced by being trained as a sociologist? Do you think you asked, was that, did that inform the kinds of questions you were asking? Was there a kind of a disciplinary angle that also is in your work?
So actually, it's true. I am not a historian by training. I'm a geographer by training. I don't have a background in sociology per se, but my postdoctoral fellowship is in the sociology department here at Wellesley College. And that's just coincidental. They were hiring someone looking for a postdoc interested in critical approaches to capitalism. So I applied. But my background in geography, which again aligns with the social sciences and sociology in key ways, definitely provoked me to think about student loan debt in unique ways because there's a focus, at least within my geography department in the UK, on neoliberalism as a regime of governance that can be understood spatially through spatial temporal fixes. And that, so neoliberalism is a phenomena of governance is necessarily a spatial phenomena. And that of course complemented my background thinking of debt between Chile and the United States.
So we've talked about neoliberalism a couple of times. I think that some of our listeners, you might not have a, you know, kind of at their fingertips definition of it. I think we could probably talk about neoliberalism for a lot longer than the time we have tonight. But how are you using that as an understanding and as a framing mechanism in this piece?
I understand neoliberalism to be a historically situated period of capital accumulation and also an ideological project which first emerged in the years following World War II and as the U.S. attained global geopolitical supremacy. One of the key driving features of the neoliberal project has been financialization, or the growth and growing power of financial markets and institutions in social life, economically, politically, socially.
Oh, I just, you know, one of the working definitions I heard, and I offer this to you not as a suggestion, but as someone who's thought about it a lot more in a lot more detail, was it's a way of using the market and depending on the market to achieve liberal goals. But maybe that's not even fair. Maybe that's not even right. With the idea that, so would something like tax incentives, is that a neoliberal tool that you do, you want to achieve a particular goal, but rather than a government mandate, it's somehow using the market to incentivize things. Is that far too simple? Does that play into this, how this is working?
No, I think that's an excellent way of thinking about it. It's the use of the market as a mode of governance. It's modeling social life, including the state and the functions of the state, on the market. So, for instance, there are three primary approaches to neoliberalism studies, all of which come to bear in my research and in the piece in the Journal of American History. And an ideational approach refers to neoliberalism as an intellectual and a political movement which began in the 1920s and which understood markets and market competition not as something that is naturally producing and contingent on limited state intervention, but rather that needed states to produce, secure, and maintain markets. So from that starting point, you have the market and the state begin to merge together as an ideological project.
I mean, so do you see the student loan and not to jump too far ahead, but this process around creating student loans has become such a massive, you know, political topic, but also such a massive economic impact. Is the student loans, is it an example of neoliberalism in the 1960s? Is this a turning point? I mean, how does this fit in? If you had to slot, I'm looking at student loans, thinking about neoliberalism because it serves this kind of function in the history of this ideological and economic concept.
Yeah. So the 1960s, I think, in particularly in my focus, the Johnson administration and the Great Society, is an important point to think about a transition to market-based governance. Mm-hmm. And the student loan industry demonstrates that. There's a shift towards making basic social provisioning like education, like housing, contingent on market incorporation. So this comes to bear in the case of student loans, tethering an expanded access of higher education to individual student loan debt burdens. Mm-hmm. Just as it comes in the case of housing and the extension of federally guaranteed mortgages to groups, particularly Black borrowers who had previously been excluded from mortgage opportunities. So it's not coincidental that, for instance, the Housing and Urban Development Act of 1968, which Kianga Yamada Taylor talks about in her book, Race for Profit, established the Government National Mortgage Association, or Ginnie Mae, as an institution which could extend mortgages to predominantly Black and poor borrowers, but was also the first institution to roll out mortgage-backed securities. So there's a push during this period to tie access to basic social provisions to the market, to market incorporation.
So when Johnson, as you described in your piece, comes forward and says, you know, higher education is no longer a luxury, but a necessity, I think some people could take that to be then, you know, with the kind of a vision that some people have, or an understanding, a misunderstanding perhaps, of the Great Society, is that that means that the government's going to step in and do education, pay for it. Do you think that Lyndon Johnson at this point, when he first brings about it, is imagining more of a government run? Are they already imagining this to be realized as a neoliberal project? Or is it he announces a goal and how it will be worked out is just left to be decided?
So in 1964, the Johnson administration initiated an outside task force to look into the development of a student loan program. And the recommendations that the task force put forward very much resemble what ultimately came to pass, which was a federal program of guaranteed student loans. And the task force recommendations were that the responsibility of paying for education ultimately couldn't rest with the federal government. Mm. The federal government could provide certain tools, for instance, loans, but it couldn't be responsible for the investment in education itself. And it explicitly said in the working documents for that task force that that responsibility needed to be taken on by the people who would benefit from the education itself.
So there was already an understanding that this was going to be some kind of private-public partnership moving forward, that it wasn't simply going to be the loans coming from the government. They were going to work something out, but they didn't know exactly what form that was going to take. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And in the initial proposal that they put forth in January of 1965 for the Guaranteed Student Loan Program within the Higher Education Act of 1965, they left quite a bit of space for private and state student loan guarantee agencies, which were operating at the time. It said that the federal government wouldn't guarantee loans in a state where there was a private or state entity guaranteeing loans on comparable terms to those proposed by the federal government.
And I think this is the part of your, like, you know, I don't do the Great Society. I don't study it necessarily. But I knew about the Johnson side of it. The part that I didn't know about, and the part that really opened up in your piece, is the story of what was going on prior to that in the 1950s with the United Student AIDS funds. And that really is a piece of your story that I think is crucial to understand what is going to come out, those, what is going to fill those spaces that Johnson's leaving in 64, 65 is really what you supply. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So United Student Aid Funds was a nonprofit organization, the first private guarantee agency for student loans operating nationally. And it was founded by the Volcker Fund, a neoliberal think tank in 1960. So they established, they developed the idea of United Student Aid Funds in 1958, and they incorporated it as a nonprofit in 1960. So the backstory of the Volcker Fund is relevant here. The Volcker Fund was a think tank initially established in the 1930s, but then developed into a think tank with a market focus in the late 40s. And it was a short-lived group that dissolved in the mid-60s, but they were key in establishing a foundation for a neoliberal thought collective in the United States and neoliberal institutions at a key moment when in the development of neoliberal ideas. For instance, they funded lecture tours and university faculty positions for neoliberal intellectuals like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, Ludwig von Mises. And they also funded U.S. participation in the first meetings of the Mont Pelerin Society, another key node in a neoliberal nexus. And also were pivotal in the establishment of the New School of Economics at the University of Chicago.
Right.
And so it was through that organization that United Student Aid Funds emerged explicitly as an attempt to demonstrate that markets could be a means to provide access to basic social provisioning.
So, would you say that this is kind of, that they are self-consciously seeing this as a proof text of a proof of concept of neoliberalism as an alternative system of approaching the goals of government through a whole totally different means?
Absolutely. They explicitly looked for what the person who developed the idea for United Student Aid Funds was a man named Richard Cornell. And he, as working as a program coordinator at the Volcker Fund in the 1950s, developed his understanding of what he referred to as the independent sector. He has a thesis, which is published in a book in 1965, in which he discusses his approach to understanding the market as a means of providing basic social provisions as an alternative to government. And in developing his thesis and his writings on this topic, he had the opportunity at the Volcker Fund to, in his words, choose a test case for this. And within the Volcker Fund, he establishes the Foundation for Voluntary Welfare as an organization to explore his thesis of the independent sector. And they develop initially proposals and ideas surrounding elder care homes, actually, in the United States as a potential way to go about thinking about market, the market as a means of providing access to care within society. But quickly in 1958, they abandoned that idea and they transitioned to a focus on student loans.
So so you have these kind of two factors, you have these kind of two threads, right? But they're not absolutely connected, right? Is it kind of a fait accompli that these two things are going to get together and the form of student loans that we get is inevitable because these people are working on this. This is their test case. Johnson steps into this. And this is it always going to go the way that it goes? Or are there other roads not taken? Or how do these two things become intertwined?
In my research, I found that the government and the particular initiatives of the United Student Aid Funds became intertwined through the banking community, and in particular, the role of the American Bankers Association, the largest lobby group for banks in the United States. And so throughout the early 1960s, United Student Aid Funds was providing private guarantees for student loans operating in most states. And when Johnson proposes the Higher Education Act and the government student loan program, United Student Aid Funds initially says you don't need to do the program at all. We can already cover it privately through the market. But through United Student Aid Funds partnership with the American Bankers Association, there is a political expediency, which is that the government is going to provide a greater network and greater access to the market ultimately.
So this, as I was reading the piece, I was going back and forth. Yeah, I mean, the kind of idea of capture, right? Of capture in which the kind of society, the group or the economy or the part of the economy that's being, you know, regulated then captures the government that's regulating it and then can control its own regulation. And I wondered if that is a model for this, but it almost seems like that's not the model because this relationship is almost baked in at the origin. Does that make any sense? Is that a way of understanding of this, or is that not what's happening here?
It was interesting to see the back and forth between the private sector and federal officials. For instance, within the American Bankers Association, the executive vice president, Charles Walker, a guy from Texas, he was a member of the Treasury during the Eisenhower years. He then joins the American Bankers Association during the Kennedy and Johnson years. And when Nixon is elected, he goes back and becomes undersecretary of the Treasury. And so he works on student loan legislation both within the American Bankers Association and also within the federal government. And I traced his correspondence and kind of material records through his private records at the Hoover Institution and just finding his signature on all sorts of documents in both the Johnson Library and the Nixon Library. So there's definitely a back and forth that shapes the acceptability of these programs. Another example of that is that the lead legal counsel for United Student Aid Funds, a guy named Edward McCabe, who was very active in lobbying the government and lobbying Congress and the White House throughout the late 1960s, becomes the founding chairman of the Student Loan Marketing Association in 1973. So there's a way in which there's definitely a back and forth between the groups.
But as this is emerging, I notice, I mean, there are a few hints here and there, but was there any viable other alternative? I mean, I know that Senator Vance Hodge, right, from Indiana has an idea on the floor, but is that ever a real challenge, or is this always the way this is going to go?
It didn't have to go this way. There were definitely political decisions. And Vance Hartke's legislation, again, kind of reproduced the notion of student loans and individuals taking on student loans, even if they were offered through the government.
Right.
But there was pushback from various groups. For instance, the National Association of State Universities and land-grant colleges sent very clear letters to the White House saying that this was not the right direction to go, that causing people to take on individual debt burdens would be essentially a process of debt indenture. And they instead advocated for direct subsidies to public universities to keep tuition manageable and low. And there were groups, other groups as well. For instance, the College Board, which is a nonprofit dealing with educational access.
Sure.
In 1970, there's a great op-ed that they write in their College Board Review, in which they basically outline what becomes contemporary, all of the contemporary issues we know surrounding student loan today. Debt today, for instance, people saddled with $50,000 of debt, people not buying homes, people not getting married, having children. So there was an awareness of what was happening at the time. One of the interesting places where I saw this occur, which is not apparent in the JAH piece, but I'm writing about it elsewhere, is that the White House and And various people who both supported and opposed the development of the Student Loan Marketing Association referred to the threat of a negative dowry for women.
Oh.
So a negative dowry of student loans, because they could see what a debt burden would mean for traditional understandings of the family and gendered relations therein. So there was there was a concern that women wouldn't be able to get married, that it would harm their marriage prospects, and that it would cause disharmony in the family as well.
So there was, I mean, whether it's a system of you give money to the school so that the credit hour stays at a low rate, or are there also ideas of grants? Is that also, is that out there? Or is it mainly institution? The alternative was an institutional rather than an individual focus.
Right. Well, in the Higher Education Act of 1965, there is a program of grants that's initiated. And what detractors of the student loan system said at the time is that it's going to be much easier for private interests or for the government in a period in which they don't have, in which there are budget cuts, to get rid of the grant system and rely on loans. And that's precisely what happened. But the primary alternative that I saw proposed was one of state investment in education through funding public education.
So there is a kind of the Johnson administration is open to public-private, is in fact never pushing a kind of fully federal government underwriting option. There's an option out there that is combined with this, and now we see that these two things intertwine despite there being other alternatives. But when it's launched, is it successful out of the gate?
I think that would depend on how you are defining success.
Sure, great.
So by 1973, the Office of Education, what is today the Department of Education, the federal government had paid over $130 million on defaulted student loans from the Guaranteed Student Loan Program alone, not even including defaulted national defense loans.
Right.
So in that sense, there were struggles, that the same struggles that we see today in terms of defaults, were happening right at the start of the industry. There was also quite a bit of work to get the program off the ground, precisely because there had been a prioritization of United Student Aid funds within the rollout of the Guaranteed Student Loan Program. By 1968, so basically, after a process of several months of lobbying, the federal guarantee of student loans within the Guaranteed Student Loan Program was relegated to a provisional basis if private groups and primarily United Student Aid funds couldn't guarantee the loans themselves. And by 1968, in over 19 states, they had had to trigger the federal guarantee because United Student Aid funds couldn't keep up with the increased loans being taken out through the federal program. And so the Office of Education, rather than just taking on the loans themselves, offered the opportunity to United Student Aid funds to co-insure the loan. So they would insure a portion, and United Student Aid funds would insure a portion. This really angered United Student Aid funds. They advocated for the government to just give them the money.
Sure.
So that they
sure.
could insure the loans 100% themselves. But the government opted not to do that. And the American Bankers Association during that period sided with the Office of Education and said, no, this is a stronger path forward. But it was through those initial difficulties that it became clear that there needed to be greater liquidity within the program, or what they referred to as the need for private liquidity for the federal program. And that's when the development of various proposals for a quote unquote student loan bank began to circulate. Though they had been talking about the notion of some sort of student loan bank from the beginning, that it wasn't like it came out of nowhere. They had been talking about that in the early 1960s as well, when they were developing the Higher Education Act.
So the big crisis is that there's so many people drawing on it that there's not enough money in the USAF funds to go out. And what their suggestion is, well, you could solve this by just giving us a whole lot more money. And instead, they want to, in a sense, not just pour money into this, but instead bring them in as part of the guarantors in the front side.
Right, exactly. So yeah. When they couldn't raise the funds and they didn't have the funds to guarantee the loans themselves, they preferred the government to give them the money to guarantee the loans, providing seed money, essentially.
So the question to be answered is, how can we get more money into the system? And the bank is the student loan bank is the solution. Or are we moving towards securitization at this point?
Well, so it's precisely that. It's the idea that a student loan bank, what would become the Student Loan Marketing Association, could provide private liquidity for the program. Student loan asset-backed securities don't develop until the late 1980s, early 1990s.
Right. So we're in a page where that's possibly, you can see it on the horizon, but it's not here yet.
You could absolutely see it on the horizon because it was happening with housing at the time.
Oh, right.
Through the development of mortgage-backed securities. And I was just this past summer back at the Johnson Library, and I went to the Nixon Library for the first time to do some more follow-up research for my book. And it became so apparent that, in particular, the American Bankers Association was consistently within the archive using housing legislation as a model for student loans.
Oh, that's so interesting. So would you say that, I don't want to jump way ahead, is there commonalities, maybe only in the fact of their existence, but is there commonalities between the housing collapse and the student loan crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. So there is a document that I was looking at from the American Bankers Association Student Loan Advisory Group that I came across at the Nixon Library that had been passed on to the Nixon administration. And they talked about the need for, just as there was a Fannie Mae and a Freddie Mac, there needed to be a Sally Mae. And so it was using that as a model for student loans. So with the advent of mortgage-backed securities that are being targeted towards racialized groups and the poor, beginning with the government National Mortgage Association, Ginnie Mae, in 1968, this sets a foundation which leads directly to the 2008 financial crisis and the various practices of subprime lending. And that's precisely the same terrain that student loans are developed from, out of, and served as a model for student loans. Of course, the key difference here is that if you have a mortgage on a house, there is an asset, a physical asset that can be taken back. And with education, that's not the case, which is why bankruptcy legislation became so key right at the beginning of the industry.
Right. So that bankruptcy has always been the fact that this debt seems to be treated unlike other debt. And when does that occur and why?
It occurs immediately. So as they're developing the student loan bank, what would become Sally Mae, United Student Aid Funds is sounding the alarm in the early 1970s, talking about the threat of bankruptcy and defaults, potentially undermining the program as a whole. And this becomes extremely explicit, both through correspondence from the United Student Aid Funds and also within the Office of Education upon the establishment of the Student Loan Marketing Association, where officials talk about, they state explicitly, now there's liquidity for the program, we need to protect that liquidity. And the way to do that is to enact bankruptcy reforms. As I mentioned, the Office of Education was paying tens of millions of dollars on defaults by 1968, by 1970. And so that was considered an important issue that had to be addressed immediately.
I mean, some of our listeners may not know, but can you describe you know, fairly, you know, what are the rules that are different for student loan debt than other kinds of debt in the U.S.?
So one of the key things that emerges from this period and directly from the concerns of the Office of Education and United Student Aid Funds was what is referred to as a time lapse rule, which prevented borrowers from discharging a student loan through bankruptcy within 5 years of its first coming due. And this is established via 1976 amendments to the Bankruptcy Act. And they were approved by a working task force, which included former members of United Student Aid Funds and the Office of Education. So today, it's virtually impossible to declare bankruptcy on student loans. And the seeds of this were planted beginning in the 1970s. For instance, the 1976 amendments to the Bankruptcy Act included a time-lapse rule that established that student loan borrowers couldn't discharge a loan through bankruptcy within 5 years of its first coming due, but that it could avoid the time-lapse rule if a borrower could prove that repayment constituted an undue hardship. And this notion of an undue hardship has persisted into the present, and it's been consistently determined with extremely harsh scrutiny to make student loans virtually impossible to discharge through bankruptcy today.
And that's different from other kinds of debt, right? Which is, I mean, part of this question of the, you know, you're going to have the dowry problem is that you make this debt largely undischargeable, unlike someone who has a failed business or, you know, other kinds of loans that you can get out of through Chapter 11 or Chapter 7, or depending on exactly what kind of loans you have. I mean, they really have created a debt that stays with you and have singled this kind of debt out to be treated differently.
Yes. And I think, again, one of the reasons for this is that the idea of an education is so intangible. Mm-hmm. So it's something that can't be reclaimed per se. So it has to be disciplined.
Right. In the sense that there's not a tangible asset, that you've received something that can't be simply taken back. So it's unlike other kinds of loans in which there is something there that can be discharged through the bankruptcy process. We can't discharge some of the classes you took in your freshman year to recoup some of that money.
Precisely. It can't be repossessed.
Yeah. So one of the things we haven't really talked about is looking from this point forward, what is the scale of student debt in the American economy? Like, how big is student debt as a, not only as a problem, but just as a factor in the lives of modern day Americans? Or if on a historical basis, how has that grown since the 1970s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, student loan debt, as people know, is astronomical in this country. There's about $1.6 trillion in collectively held student loan debt, and it's the second highest consumer debt behind only mortgages. And 43 million people share the burden of this debt. Wow. And it's worth noting that about 90% of this student loan debt is federally held. So federal student loans account for 90% of all student debt. And, you know, getting back to the notion of a negative dowry, 2/3 of outstanding borrowers are women.
Right.
And of course, this is racialized in very not surprising ways, with Black women shouldering the heaviest burden.
So, I mean, and has the presidential administration made much difference? Because it was surprising in your piece that, or maybe it wasn't surprising, that the piece kind of transitions from the Johnson administration to the Nixon administration, but the policies don't seem to be shockingly different. Is there much of a sense of discontinuation or discontinuity between these two administrations?
Not at all. From what I have seen, it was very seamless. The Nixon administration took on precisely the plans for the Student Loan Marketing Association and ran with it. Again, the Undersecretary of the Treasury, Charles Walker, during the Nixon administration, was one of the key architects of the Student Loan Marketing Association during the Johnson years when he was working for the American Bankers Association. So I suppose I also wasn't surprised, but it was a very seamless transition. Another factor shaping that for the Johnson administration, I think in a way in which the Johnson administration understood the guaranteed student loan program as a success, is that upon initiating many Great Society programs, it had to start slashing funding for it, in large part due to its escalation of the war in Southeast Asia, its war in Southeast Asia. And so student loans and the partnerships with the banks and with the United Student Aid Funds was looked at as a way to fund the program that wouldn't be a burden on the federal government itself.
And in that process of slashing, did they give up oversight, or was that kind of federal oversight not so much there in the first place? Did it structurally change when they had to start slashing? I mean, was it just a change in the financing?
I didn't see it as a structural change in the case of student loans, because it was already geared towards the partnerships with the banks and with the private guarantee agencies. And so it was a way of saying that this was a successful program and it's working as it should. And the Johnson administration referred to this, in relationship to student loans at least, as successful examples of what it referred to as creative federalism. And that term is interesting because it's not used in a way in which a legal scholar, constitutional scholar, would necessarily understand federalism as a division between the federal government and states. In terms of the student loan industry and student loan programs, it's consistently used in reference to the partnership between the federal government and the banking community. So I mentioned earlier the issue of co-insurance in the late 1960s, when the federal government had to step in and co-insure student loans with the United Student Aid Funds. And Douglas Cater, the presidential assistant on education, wrote to Johnson a memo upon completion of the idea of a co-insurance program, and said, this is an example of creative federalism at work. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so much that the lack of funds and the slashing of funds for Great Society programs, it didn't impact student loans per se, because student loans were established to work through this private partnership. But it was an entryway for the private partnership to be justified and entrenched.
Right. So, I mean, so, you know, this wasn't, when I first thought this might be an idea of a system that was created in a way, and then it was recaptured, it was changed. But it seems like the system that we have now is exactly how the system was designed.
I would say exactly. I would say precisely that's, it's working as it was initially designed to work.
Now, were there moments, and you said at the beginning, there were some people who pushed back against this and said, you know, the dowry issue that we talked about, or the issue of it should instead be funded a different way. But since then, have there been any efforts, you know, or decision points, particularly in this early period, were there other alternatives that were suggested, or has the system largely maybe hardened and expanded, but structurally it's not that much different? Or have there been times where there were off ramps that it could look different that were not taken or closed off?
I think precisely it's expanded, entrenched, it's become a juggernaut, the student loan industry, what some scholars have referred to as student finance complex. Mm-hmm. And I think one off ramp that we've seen recently was the end of the student loan pause this past year in 2023. For the first time since the student loan industry began, student loan payments were were suspended. And this was initiated by the Trump administration in March of 2020 as a response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And the suspension of federal student loan payments was consistently reauthorized by both the Trump administration and then the Biden administration. And it was the Biden administration which decided to restart payments without a large-scale cancellation of loans, mm-hmm. but universally for borrowers.
Right.
And so that was one opportunity to enact a change, but the political will wasn't there by any means. The Biden administration builds the resumption of student loan payments as an opportunity to return to normal following the pandemic. So for the Biden administration, it was more of student loans were paused because of the pandemic, not because there were are underlying structural issues with the student loan industry. Sure. It's acknowledged that there are problems, but it's operating from the idea that those problems can be reformed.
Right. Now, you said that the housing market kind of gave a model to the student loan industry. Has the student loan industry served as a model for anything else moving forward?
That's a really interesting question, and it's one that I would want to explore explicitly in terms of thinking of student loans, not just within the United States, but globally, and the fact that certain countries have adopted a program of student loans and others have not. I am intrigued by the fact that the contemporary student loan program in the United States emerged in the 1980s. During the Pinochet dictatorship, but after the student loan industry was already fully in place in the United States. So we often, when we think about neoliberalism, Chile is cited as the test case, the quote unquote mm-hmm. test case where policies were first tested out. But in the case of student loans, that happened first in the United States, in my understanding, and then potentially exported elsewhere.
Sure. I guess one of the questions that I had as I was reading this was that, like, on one level, should we be, and maybe we shouldn't be, and this is a question that doesn't go very far, but is this a kind of American model of that we see kind of neoliberalism, that the fact that it emerged this way is kind of the way that a lot of these public partnerships do, or even if you're selling something like Social Security under FDR, the idea of just giving people money was unacceptable. It had to be couched in a sense of this is your money and we save it and we give it back to you. And a kind of a system by there that kind of end runs the idea that the government's just directly acting in the economy, which is kind of an ongoing debate of what the government's role should be for a long time. Are these the kinds of ways that America does things? And were you surprised at any of your research about how all of this worked out?
You know, I think the thing that surprised me starting this project as a doctoral candidate was how clearly self-evident these developments were as soon as I entered the archive. Mm. And I had imagined, I told myself when I started the project, thinking about the historical origins of the student loan industry, that it would be a messy and complex project, that it wouldn't be clear cut, that there would be many different actors, and that this somehow organically emerges through complexity and through contestation. And I specifically said to myself, and maybe this was in part some of the training that I had received in higher education prior to my doctoral studies, I explicitly told myself it's not like there are men in a back room designing this, you know, like in a smoky back room. But actually, when I entered the archive, it was pretty much there were a series of back rooms, and one of those back rooms was the White House. Mm. And so the kind of clear-cut, self-evident, and obvious nature of it within the archive really struck me. It wasn't difficult to trace these developments, and it wasn't difficult to trace the role of United Student Aid Funds, even though United Student Aid Funds hasn't been critically spoken about or talked sure. about. I actually, when I started the project, I wasn't sure where to begin. And I had picked up an original copy of Milton Friedman's 1962 book, Capitalism and Freedom. And in the chapter on the role of government in education, it was actually a footnote in that chapter in which he talks about United Student Aid Funds as an example of a group that is providing student loans for higher education as a means to facilitate personal investment in higher education through the market. And that's where I first got keyed in to the role of United Student Aid Funds. I looked them up. I figured out who Richard Cornell was and read his book. And then it was just a matter of going to the Johnson Library and the Hoover Institution, where there were a number of documents where Cornell's personal papers are housed, for instance, and Charles Walker's papers are housed, to put the pieces together.
So if there is an idea that this is, it's Johnson moves down this road of wanting to have support for education, thinks there will be a private-public partnership, and this is what emerges. The people who did that, Cornell, others, do you think that, and you can pick the time period to answer the question if it changes, are they happy with what they wrought? Or do they look at the system that they put together and it's about what they wanted? Did they have to make compromises that they wish they wouldn't have had to make? Are there reluctant things that, if you pick a point in time, 76, 77, they think, well, this is 50% of what we had imagined, or is it closer to 100?
One of the interesting and truly ironic things for me in this project is that Cornell's initial idea for United Student Aid Funds was explicitly a test case of a private organization that could compete with the federal government. And when it realized it couldn't compete with the federal government, it attempted to use the federal government to strengthen itself and achieve its means, in part through the influence of the banking community. So there are times when United Student Aid Funds pushed back on ideological grounds, for instance, the issue of coinsurance, and said, we shouldn't partner with the government. We should do it ourselves, even though they were still asking the government to give them money.
Right.
But it was consistently the banking community and the American Bankers Association who did not hold that ideological commitment, that looked for political expediency and working with and through the government to achieve the development of the student loan industry. So the end result of this is really not what Richard Cornell envisioned with United Student Aid Funds as an entity that would compete with the federal government. And in that sense, his whole approach is more libertarian than it is necessarily neoliberal. But it was his placement in operation within a think tank that was interested in this approach to the market as a form of governance that made his ideas, that lubricated his ideas and made them function within a system that ultimately promoted a merging of government and private offices.
So given his, given the dream 58, 60, it would have simply been the government would have never gotten involved in this space at all. And it would have just simply been handled by private finance.
Absolutely. And they came when Johnson first proposed the Guaranteed Student Loan Program. And prior to that, with Vance Hartke's proposal for a relatively similar federally operating student loan guarantee agency, and said, the government doesn't need to be involved at all. And it's best if you drop it.
Right, right.
Because we can handle it.
Well, another thing that came up was there was a time where we were working on our magazine, The American Historian, talking about, you know, emerging fields in American history. And one of those that I still feel like it's emerging, though maybe you may tell me it's already emerged, is the history of NGOs and think tanks that maybe the work is done and I just haven't seen it and I'd love to know more about it. But where is that field of, there's an entire world of whether it's RAND or these other places that are doing important work that at one point I think we would have thought would have been naturally done by someone in elected office or someone in the government bureaucracy. But that work of determining whether it's writing laws or determining policy or coming up with theories that are really powerful in foreign policy are being done in think tanks. And where is the field now of looking at NGOs? And my other question is, how much more difficult is it to study an NGO than to study a government agency?
If I can answer the second part of that question first, because, you know, the Volcker Fund, as a think tank, its papers were lost. It's ultimately its funds were given to the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, but the papers for the group were lost. So that was difficult. It was particularly difficult researching the American Bankers Association, who I contacted repeatedly when I first started the project to see if I could speak with someone there or access their records. And of course, that was not going to happen. And in the end, it wasn't a problem because there were plenty of correspondence and documents passed from the American Bankers Association to the Johnson and Nixon administrations to look at. So that research is a little bit more complicated. It was easier for me to access the materials through the National Archives.
Sure.
Though that said, yeah, sometimes it's easier to access things through the National Archives than others as well, because I think the National Archives is struggling with funds and making accessible certain papers. The key area of scholarship that I've come to since finishing my doctoral studies and really since writing the paper for the Journal of American History is the interdisciplinary field of critical approaches to financialization and looking at the role of the growth of finance and financial markets from the 1970s onwards as a key feature of neoliberalism. That critical scholarship on financialization, which really looks and focuses on states of debt and indebtedness.
Sure.
And the lived experiences of debt and indebtedness as a key functioning of neoliberalism, in part because credit is extended by the state instead of a living wage, which makes debt under neoliberalism distinct, because debt certainly isn't anything new, as we
know.
And it's also then the commodification of that debt that has been extended to make ends meet through its circulation on financial markets that makes it also a site of capital accumulation.
Right. I mean, one of the interesting things in the piece is the kind of citizenship of debt holders, that you become, that one of the invitations into education or something else is by taking on of debt, and that is a kind of a mark of a crucial part of moving into American society is being able to carry that debt, and that debt then being securitized or financial, a part of that's exchanged. Like that came through the piece really strong of the, what does it mean to carry debt and add debt and hold debt, and how that's a marker of the way American citizenship has evolved.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that Kianga Yamada Taylor writes about, again, in relationship to the Johnson administration and housing policy, as predatory inclusion. Mm-hmm. So you're getting social access, but it's coming through indebtedness in the market. And Jaleel Mustafa and Caleb Dawson write about the Black student loan debt crisis in their terms in relationship, again, to predatory inclusion.
Right.
Okay, you're getting access to education beginning in the 1960s. It's being expanded to groups that previously didn't have access. Black people, women, middle and lower classes, but it's coming through a necessary debt obligation that is going to be commodified. It's going to potentially replace a living wage for many people, and then it's going to be sold on financial markets. So right. Feminist scholars of financialization in particular look at how social reproduction has been financialized over this period of time. So the productive activities of education, health, maintaining a home, et cetera, become, in Silvia Federici's terms, immediate sites of capital accumulation.
Right.
So it's really, it gets down to the everyday and the intimate scale of people's livelihoods. And I think we can also see that in the growth of consumer credit more broadly in the United States, where it also becomes a lifestyle for a lot of people. It's a way of making ends meet, yes, but it also becomes an ideological apparatus of understanding our relationship to the state as consumers, as both entrepreneurs and consumers.
Well, I mean, with the expansion of, you know, that there's not a big lag between essentially the freezing of wages in the 70s and the expansion of the credit card industry, right? That these are kind of, that the expansion of the credit card industry takes place of where otherwise you would have had wage expansion.
Precisely. And scholars of financialization have also, of course, looked at microcredit mm-hmm. and the extension of loans to populations who previously were excluded from markets totally. And so that their productive capacities are now incorporated into a global financial apparatus.
I guess one of the questions and the challenges of this kind of work is, how do we then evaluate the pros and cons? I mean, that there's clearly the expansion of debt, but there's also the expansion of education. As someone who's, you know, in the middle of both of this, whether Johnson was right that a higher education is not a luxury but a necessity. If so, how do you as a scholar, how does the field think about these trade-offs of expansion of opportunity, arguably of the importance of education itself, of the way that education is a positive good, but with the system that has come along with it, how do you weigh that, the pros and cons, and how do you evaluate then overall and think about the student debt process and the industry that's evolved?
That's a great question. You know, honestly, I don't think of it as a trade-off. We certainly don't need student loans, massive tuition, massive debt burdens to create a space of learning in society. Mm-hmm. So this was a choice that was developed from particular ideological frameworks that promoted the notion that humans, people should invest for themselves in higher education rather than thinking of education as a social good that everyone could benefit from. And so I don't think it's so much a trade-off as a regime of governance. Mm-hmm. And I think that student loans are operating as part and parcel of the state in contemporary governance as the market. Mm-hmm. So this is something that Tressie McMillan Cottom talks about in her book, Lower Ed, which looks at the production of for-profit colleges mm-hmm. and particularly how for-profit colleges come to the fore in the 1990s, 90% of their revenue being derived from federal student loans.
Right.
She talks in the book about the idea of credentialism and the idea that you need credentials to access the labor market. I think we need to question the quality of education. Mm-hmm. And if education has now just become a means of accessing the market for people, but also a system of education that prioritizes certain fields of studies over others, not the least of which would be finance.
Sure. Sure. Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today. I think the article is going to be of interest to a lot of people. I think that the amount of attention being shown on student loans is only increasing. And I think your article gives a great idea of where this came from and how those early years really set the model for the decades of evolution that have happened after.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk today.
Music for this podcast features King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band's 1923 recording of Mabel's Dream. King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band was one of the first Black American jazz ensembles to receive a recording contract from Paramount Records. In its early years, the band featured Joe Oliver, Louis Armstrong, Johnny Dodds, Honor Daughtry, Lil Armstrong, Johnny St. Cyr, and Babe Dodds. Thanks for listening to the Journal of American History podcast. Follow us on X at The Jam Hist and Facebook at The Journal of American History to hear about upcoming episodes like this. For more bite-sized history content, listen to our blogcast episodes. Have ideas or content you'd like to see on our show? Email us at jahcast@oah.org.